Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
So Matt and I went to a recording of the Radio 4 program, Master Tapes, and it was recorded at the Maida Vale Studios, the historic BBC Maida Vale Studios.
Of course.
And we sat approximately 10 feet away, and we were in the second row, while for an hour and a half, Randy Newman played through his highlights of his back catalogue and took questions.
Specifically about Sail Away.
Yeah, so the album that he was specifically talking about was Sail Away, which is his third studio record, early 70s. And the thing about Randy Newman is, he's a great songwriter.
He's the best, I think.
And but also, he is funny.
Yeah.
Matt. Proper
I
funny.
I mean, he is proper funny in his... So when he plays the songs, if you've ever seen him live, you sort of know how the song's going to go. You know, he tends to knock them out, bang, bang, bang. What he says between the songs is just gold dust. And Matt and I were talking about this, wasn't he? He's got that incredible timing where he can do so much with so little, right?
He's one of my big loves of life. I was first actually turned on to his music by when I was doing my MA in English and American Literature from 1880 to the present day. One of my tutors sat us down and said, "You will learn more about America by reading and listening to these lyrics than you will from any book about anything."
He's very funny about the Pixar songs. And he said, "Well, that's what most people know me for. It's like I had a second chance in about the year 2000, where I suddenly became known. And my job is not to pack away some hidden message." They said what we want the song to be about in Toy Story is he's a kid and there's a cowboy and they're friends. And so I went, "You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me." They went, "That's exactly what we're looking for."
It's
genius.
You know.
And it's a lovely song.
It's a great song. But there's just something about everything he does that even though he's playing it straight, you know, there's just the intonation. I mean, I remember sitting in with small children watching that and turning to us and saying, this is Randy Newman. They've done the Pixar. I've got Randy Newman to do the thing. And an unthinkable thing for a children's movie. But it worked perfectly. But there's just that edge of humour in his voice.
Like Derek Jacobi narrating in The Night Garden, you can always tell that he's viewing it in several different perspectives.
Oh, classicism. We're going to talk about...
I'm really hoping that there are successive generations of children who will come to the work of Randy Newman in their teens.
Through Toy Story.
Great. What a magnificent thing that is. It must have happened that they stumble upon these
kids are going, "Oh, mums, turn that off. What on earth is that you're listening to?" They actually did hear me playing Randy Newman. They go, "Is that the guy from Toy Story?"
Matt enjoys Randy's work almost as much as he enjoys the work of Warren Zevon as well, right?
Possibly more.
Well, with the sound of Randy Newman in our ears, should we start? Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. We're gathered on the bank above a stretch of river in the garden of our sponsors Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to create something special. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously, and my forthcoming one-man show, Andy Miller Plays Sad Songs on a Guitar He Found in a Skip. why are you laughing?
Just because it's funny, Andy, sorry.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. And joining us today are the novelist and critic Alex Preston. Hello, Alex Preston.
Hello, Andy. Hello, John.
Hello, Andy.
And Alex is the author of three novels, is that right?
Yep, well done.
Three novels, This Bleeding City, The Revelations in Love and War, and you're also the co-author of a new book which I'm just going to linger on very slightly, called As Kingfishers Catch Fire, which is a collaboration with the designer and artist Neil Gower, which I was very fortunate your publisher sent me a copy this week.
It's a beautiful,
it's a beautiful book, right? Can you just tell people what it is?
It's a celebration of birds in literature, and it's illustrated and it goes through bird by bird. So you have the swallow from Ovid to Ted Hughes. Mm. You have the barn owl from Shelley to Richard Mabey. And all of them with paintings by Neil.
And Neil painted these specifically, didn't he?
Yes, I would send him the chapter that I'd written, which attempts to kind of draw out these various kind of literary references to the birds through time.
Can't wait to see it.
It's beautiful.
Do you know what they've done? And actually Corsair, who have done, I mean, they've done an extraordinary job with it. It's strokeable.
It is. And we're also joined today by Unbound editor-at-large, Rachel Kerr. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, everyone.
And Rachel is not only Unbound editor-at-large, she is also John Mitchinson's carer and helper.
That's right, Andy, that's right.
That's right,
isn't it? That is right, yeah.
They are spousally arranged.
Sometimes,
yes. And Rachel is here for a specific reason other than assisting John today. So we're going to come on to that.
In the orchard of Guestage, yes, an apple has been plucked. So the book we're here to talk to Alex and Rachel about is Haunts of the Black Masseur by Charles Sprawson. Engaging title. Amazing book.
Haunts of the Black Masseur is a book about... It was published in the early 90s, and it's a book about swimming. So we're also going to be talking about... We've had other specials on Backlisted. I suppose this is our swimming special.
Yeah.
I did try and persuade you to have it outdoors.
Tell people what you suggested. Right? Yeah.
Well, I suggested that you come down. I live on the south coast near Rye, and I suggested you come and have a swim in the river near my house, and then we record the podcast, you know, in the open air.
I was all for it. I love a bit of river swimming.
Everyone who knows me went, has he ever met me? does he understand? Has he ever actually listened to this podcast?
Well, I thought maybe, you know, we could have got one of those bathing engines, you know, one of the things that you wheel down to the river. You could have a natty little sort of cardigan type swimsuit.
I would not remove my tie.
Anyway, let's crack on. Andy, what damp book have you been reading this week?
So I've been reading a book by our former guest on Backlisted, John Grindrod, who came in and talked about 6 months ago about Memento Mori by Muriel Spark. And John has a new book out called Outskirts, Living Life on the Edge of the Green Belt. And John grew up in New Addington, which is a estate area on the outskirts of Croydon. So this is a book about... He does a really clever thing at the beginning of the book where he says, we lived in the last road in London. We lived in the edge of the estate, where if you look behind us, you could see the estate, and if you looked in front of us, you could see the green belt. And in a sense, looking in both directions at the same time is what the book is about, as somebody who grew up in the suburbs, or about what the function of the green belt is. And one of the things that is so interesting about the book, he basically weaves two strands together. One is about the history of the green belt. And one of the things that you learn from the book is that whatever you think you understand by the term green belt, the more you think about it and read about it, the less you know. It sort of can mean a huge variety of different things to different people in different political contexts. So in that respect, it's similar to his previous book, which is called Concretopia. But it's also a memoir of growing up in the suburbs. And I must say that I found reading it, it was one of those books that I read with my ever-present chip on my shoulder, thinking, right, why aren't there more books like this?
Yeah.
There should be more books like this by people who live in the places that most people live, not the inner city and not Hampstead.
Edgelands.
You know,
Paul Farley's Edgelands.
There are so few books that deal with the places most people live, right? And John and I did an event at Rough Trade a few weeks ago where we tried to talk about a few of the books that might feature, and it's hard to get beyond 9 or 10.
Richard Mabey's brilliant on that. Yeah. You know, that's where he grew up as well, and that's what nourished his...
We were talking about fiction.
And
we
Paul
were talking
Farley
about,
did.
Paul Farley,
Edgeland. Edgeland is a great book.
Red Hill Rococo by Sheena Mackay.
Sheena Mackay, yeah.
Beyond Black by Hilary Mantel. You know, Beyond right. Black by Millie
and Nobbs, the whole Nobbs.
And David Nobbs, absolutely.
Which, I guess Jonathan Coe is sort of in...
There's two things I want to say about the book. I found the book very interesting and moving, but I also found it incredibly... It's a strange thing to say, but I really found it quite moving to see sort of my experience
in
of
print.
My place in the world
set
out in print.
Yeah.
I just want to read a little bit, which will, funnily enough, relate to what we're going to talk about for our main book. So this is from the introduction of Outskirts, and this is what John says about the Greenbelt. Despite our best efforts, on the small island of Great Britain, there are still ancient wilds, woodlands and moors where few people venture, remote and apart from the towns and cities where most of us spend our lives. Places where nature still flourishes, red in tooth and claw, green in stem and shoot, pale in frond and fin. But much of the open space in Britain is not found in rugged highlands or spectacular national parks. It is nearer the towns and cities where most of us live. A tame version of the country, with little of that edgy glamour that people seek out for rambling treks, wild swimming, or getaway weekends. It even has a name that suggests mere practicality, vanity even, as opposed to mystery and grandeur, the Green Belt. If mountains and lochs are the cinemascope version of our countryside, the Green Belt is the sitcom. Cozy. It's good, isn't it? Cozy, familiar, cyclical. To be seen in regular short bursts. It is the small, pretty flowers of Laura Ashley wallpaper, rather than the awe-inspiring atmospheric excesses of romantic painting. A frilly green doily around the edge of our cities. Here the wildlife is the grey squirrel, fox and wood pigeon, rather than the beaver, otter or wildcat. City folk might go out there for a weekend cycle, but for a proper break, seek adventure in the real wilds beyond. Highland or North Welsh folk might find this tame landscape almost funny. It's the place where cross people meet to try and put a stop to the modern world, whether it be wind farms, fracking or road widening schemes. Yet it's also full of commuters building extra bedrooms and adding value, and farms with hillsides of yellow oilseed rape or golden barley, where developers win some and lose some. And of course, there's much that's more surprising than any of this too. Strange small towns, landfill sites, abandoned military facilities, motorway service stations, follies. In England alone, the Greenbelt accounts for 13% of our total land, in Scotland 2%, in Northern Ireland 16%. Yet most of us would be hard-pressed to explain a few fundamentals about this strange phenomenon. What exactly is it? Is there more than one? If so, where can you find them? And why and how did they come about? Was it an ancient idea we inherited from the baronial landowners of yore, or something more recent and practical, like health and safety laws or immunisation? Are there people we can thank for it? And why don't we know who they are? What do these greenbelts say about our temperament, our hopes and ambitions? Are they indeed an attempt to give us a national character? When it comes to answering these questions, have the solutions been hidden in plain sight? Have we not been able to see the wood for the trees?
Oh,
he's a good writer,
isn't
that
great?
Isn't that great?
Well done,
right? And also, the thing about that, the thing that John is so brilliant about is outlining the way in which the Green Belt was a effectively socialist idea in the spirit of the NHS, and like the socialist idea in the spirit of the NHS, has been appropriated by whoever wants to appropriate
Absolutely.
It subsequently.
away
so yeah, I really recommend it. It's very moving, very political, very informative.
Good work, Grindrod.
John, what have you been reading this week?
I have been reading a book by Nell Stevens called Bleaker House. The subtitle is Chasing My Novel to the End of the World. And I have to say, it comes blazoned with it's published by Picador, very good. Blazoned with a quote from Lena Dunham saying, my favourite debut of 2017. It's difficult not to like. It's about the attempt to write a novel. managed through her university, Boston University. They have a creative writing fellowship. She got a chance to go and work in another country for 3 months to write a book. So she chose, for reasons I won't go into, she chose Bleaker Island, which is a small island off the coast of the Falkland Islands in the southwest. It has a total population of 2 people. So she kind of increased the population by 1 while she was there. It's about not writing a how not to write a novel. Mm-hmm. She came, she'd been doing a creative writing course. She had a novel mapped out in her head. I'll read you just a little bit, which gives you... It has... I mean, you know, I know everything gets compared slightly to Bridget Jones in these things, but it's much funnier than that, much wittier and wiser than that in a way. But here we go. From my writing station in the sunroom, carefully disarranged laptop and notebooks, blue pen, black pen, pencil, Bleak House. Bleak House is the novel she has with her, and it's the novel that she has a dialogue with throughout. With a view of the bay and the red-roofed shearing shed beyond it, I drink my whole day's ration of black instant coffee and make calculations. If a first novel should be 90,000 words, I read this somewhere on the internet once and cling to it as absolute indisputable fact. Then after my false starts and archive digging days in Stanley, which produced only 10,000, I have 80,000 words to go. I'm on the island for 41 days and will need to leave sometime at the end for revisions. A week or so should be enough for that, surely. So say that leaves me with 32 writing days. That's 80,000 divided by 32, which equals 2,500. I shall write 2,500 words each day, and by the time I leave Bleaker, I will have drafted and revised a whole novel. Totally doesn't happen. Totally doesn't happen. But of course, the joy and the loveliness of the book is, it's a mad idea. She's on her own for most of that time. So she does, of course, go slightly mad. Her dreams become incredibly vivid. She does write quite a lot of stuff. But what comes out of the book is not the novel. It is, in fact, Bleaker House. And I mean, it sounds tricksy. It isn't, because she's got a lovely narrative voice. She writes really well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, right? See, I like books about nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. If provided, because they often give a platform for someone who's got a particular style to expand upon that style without getting weighed down by having to convey information. So I'm quite serious about that. Does she have that? From what you read, it sounds like she has that.
And then she comes back. I'll give you the meat of the book. She gets asked by somebody, what's the punchline of your book? And she's going, oh, don't even ask me. But she comes, the punchline is that I did leave this island with a book. And here's the bullet points. Solitude is the contented twin of loneliness. Variety is a kind of company. Everything is a kind of work. Do not look into your own heart and write, but do not be surprised if you end up there all the same. despite what you think and despite what Ted Hughes might lead you to believe, there is no such thing as effortless concentration. anyway, it ends up in a very good place. And I think she's a good writer, and I think she will probably go on to write quite a good novel. But the bits of the novel that are in here, that she's incredible, I mean, it's an incredibly brave thing to do. There's bits that work better than others. Let's just say there are bits that work better than others. But the whole thing actually, weirdly, hangs together. It's a mad idea. It sort of works.
It struck me as a book. I haven't read it. I read a couple of reviews of it, and one of the reviews was a classic. We've all read and written reviews. It was a classic. See, I read the review, and I thought, I like the sound of this book, because the person who's written this review didn't get it.
No.
Right? Didn't get what was good about it. They've reviewed the book that they would have written
exactly
in that writer's shoes,
and I can see
he's furious at some level that that's not what this person decided to go ahead and do.
A lot more thought, and there's a lot more thought and a lot more care has gone into the structuring and patterning of this book.
That's that John Updike quote: "Work out what spell the writer is trying to create, and submit yourself to it as best you can. You know, and don't review a book that they didn't try and write.
You know, it's not going to change anybody's life, but it's what it is going to do is give you a few hours of. I mean, it's really, really fun. I really enjoyed it, and it's a book you do read in a couple of gulps.
I've heard of this thing called reading for pleasure.
Mm.
Would it fall into that category?
Did you notice, Andy, in the brief plug here for in the Radio Times, which podcast of the week feature this week?
Did you say podcast of the week in the Radio Times?
In the Radio Times, Andy. Oh. Yeah, Claire Malcolm from New Writing North said we've sold out now, and she's going to stop listening. We've become establishment. But
you just reminded me of a Randy Newman. Randy Newman said this brilliant story. He said he was asked in an interview recently, could you give somebody a tip for breaking into the music business? And he said, why would you want to do that? Breaking into the music business these days is like breaking into a bank that's already been robbed.
God, that's brilliant. That's like publishing. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, we should get on. We should crack on. Now, as is now traditional, or has recently been made traditional, we're going to take a break to hear from one of our authors. And the one we're going to hear from today, this is, I think, a book that works perfectly in this context, I hope. House of Fiction by Phyllis Richardson, which is a book about the great houses of fiction. None of the houses, obviously, are necessarily featured in the book that we're talking about on the podcast, but quite a few of them got swimming pools. But anyway, here is Phyllis.
My name is Phyllis Richardson. I am the author of a book called House of Fiction. It is a book about houses in literature, as they appear in English literature specifically, and the relationships that the various authors had with houses that they visited or lived in or loved or were obsessed with, and how they translated those relationships into fiction, into fictional houses that most of us know, have heard of, have read about, and may have become a little bit obsessed with ourselves. So the book begins with one of the earliest novels, Tristram Shandy, from mid-18th century, and goes right up to, well, it's the 1980s with Julian Barnes and Metroland. So I'm talking about houses in a kind of historic sense, but also in the more modern sense, how housing changed, ideas of housing, as in the suburban house, with someone like Julian Barnes, and also with J.G. Ballard talking about the high-rise. I'm reading from Chapter 9 of House of Fiction, and the title of the chapter is Rooms of Her Own, Virginia Woolf's Houses of Memory. And there's an epigraph in the beginning of the chapter. This is an extract from Virginia Woolf's diary from the 11th of August, 1905. She says, "We could fancy that we were but coming home, and that when we reached the gate at Talland House, we should thrust it open and find ourselves among the familiar sights again." In 1905, 10 years after their mother died, 8 years since the death of their half-sister Stella, 18 months since their father had also passed away, and a little over a year after she herself had made her first attempt at suicide by throwing herself out a window, Virginia Stephen and her siblings made a pilgrimage. Aged from 22 to 26, Vanessa, Toby, Virginia, and Adrian had recently embarked on an unconventional living arrangement in London that would give rise to the legendary Bloomsbury group of artists and intellectuals. But on this trip, they were taking a journey back in time to the place where they had spent 13 idyllic summers as a family. In 1881, their father, the eminent critic and biographer Leslie Stephen, had discovered Talland House in St. Ives, Cornwall, on one of his many walking expeditions. It was a three-story detached house sat on a hill overlooking Porthminster Beach with Gadrevy Lighthouse visible in the distance. And from then on, from July to September each year, Stephen installed his large family and an array of guests in the airy seaside house, which would become a touchstone for his youngest daughter's art. For Virginia Woolf, certain houses were of huge importance, and for specific reasons. Her first home in Kensington came to represent the Victorian enigma that she would battle against in her life and writing, while Talland House was a childhood idol that would inspire her throughout her life. The independent and relaxed lifestyle she was able to pursue in various residences in Bloomsbury gave her the mental space and courage to produce the experimental novels that are her defining achievement. And finally, the retreat that she and her husband Leonard Woolf had at Monk's House in East Sussex gave her the opportunity to recreate some of the atmosphere that she loved so well of those early days at Talland House, while having private space for herself and a continual stream of family friends whom she liked to see, quote, dotted about on the estate.
The House of Fiction by Phyllis Richardson is published by Unbound and available to order from all good bookshops. Backlisted listeners can get money off by ordering at unbound.com using the code BACKOFF at checkout. That's all one word, BACKOFF at checkout.
Now, here are our sponsors telling you what to do.
And now we're back in the room to get on with the main matter in hand, which is the singular book, Haunts of the Black Masseur, by Charles Sprawson.
Singular, literally singular, because this is Charles, to date, Charles Sprawson's only book, I think I'm right in saying.
And it's a great pleasure to have Alex Preston here to talk to us about it, and Rachel, of course, as well.
Alex, so where did you first run into this book?
So I was given this book by my best friend when I was, I guess, in my late teens. His name was Hugo Godwin, and he was the son of a man called David Godwin, who discovered this book. And so Hugo, best man at my wedding, and we swum together a lot and said, this is a book that you will love. And indeed, I absolutely love it and have loved it and read it and reread it ever since.
Do you think that in order to love the book, one has to be a swimmer of rivers, ponds, and canals?
No. I mean, I think you've named three of the swimming places that I think Sprawson most disapproves of. Sprawson is a sea swimmer.
He is.
In fact, there's a lovely review of the book by Iris Murdoch, where she, I think, in the New York Review of Books, where she talks about. She calls it. She says as zestful as a dip in a bath of champagne or something. But she recognises that Sprawson looks down on her because she is a river swimmer. Sprawson likes swimming where there's a lot of danger, and there's no danger in rivers and ponds.
Okay, that's a fair point.
But do you have to be a swimmer? No, I mean, I think it's a book for people who like books more than people who
indeed,
like
indeed. I quite agree. Rachel, where did you first encounter Haunts of the Black Masseur?
Well, I was actually working at Jonathan Cape with David Godwin when Hugo was probably about 10. and I was the publicist for this book when it first came out. And it was one of those moments in publishing where you read a book that is quite unlike any other book that you've ever read. And there was a marvellous sort of glamour about Sprawson, who was this terribly well-spoken, sort of handsome, slightly military-bearing Raj, born in Pakistan in the 40s, sort of this author that came in and talked to us about the book, and there was a sort of moment where we all completely fell in love with him. And the book was just full of that easy kind of erudition, and you just felt you were learning. And I am the kind of swimmer who, I hate a swimming pool, I can't bear chlorine, but I'm the kind of swimmer that is very, very terrified of weed at the bottom or anything getting wrapped around my legs. So it made me more adventurous when I was reading it. It was just one of those books that everybody got very, very excited about fell in love with.
This book came out 25 years ago, and I remember it coming out, and I remember it being reviewed. Did you, as the publicist in charge of the book, when you were first presented with it, did you have any sense of where on the scale of how between easy and difficult it was going to be to get attention for the book?
I just fell in love with the book. And I'm one of those really tragic people that when I really love a book, I was like, you've got to read this book, and it's really complete. Yeah. I was so thrilled by it. And so I remember I used to write letters to journalists in the days before email. I mean, this was long before anyone had an email account or you sent press releases. I would write, personalised letters to journalists about things. I remember one journalist, I think it was Mick Brown at the Telegraph, once ringing me up and saying, Rachel, I can't do anything with this book, but please never stop sending me your letters, because if I was really excited about a book, it would be really effusive. And I think they probably found it quite amusing.
But Rachel, you and I were talking earlier about lending books, and I always have more than one copy of this book in my house because I'm worried that I'll give away my first edition if I don't. I love it so much, and I press it on people. So
and where's our first edition, Rachel?
I know. I think that's exactly it. When we were looking,
we were looking
for our first edition, which I have, which in my memory I think is a signed edition, but it's not on our bookshelves. And I know that I personally would never have given away a first edition of this particular book because I love it so much. So I just
Everybody's looking at me now.
Everyone's looking at you.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
After
it's true,
one
but
too
it
many,
is, it is exactly
after a particularly
that kind of
bibulous. Sunday lunch.
It is exactly that
obviously.
Kind of book.
Do read this book, it's marvellous.
It's exactly the kind of book you have a conversation and say, I like swimming, and you say, oh, have you read Sprawson? You must have read. And of course, you know, the title is remarkable enough, and we'll talk about that maybe a bit later on. But it is, I mean, from my memory, I certainly remember, I mean, I'd read this book before Rachel and I were together. I was probably one of the people you sent a letter to when I was at Waterstones. And I read it in proof and got incredibly excited about it. And I remember going to New Zealand with my then wife, and spent the whole holiday in New Zealand. It was going to a friend's wedding, trying to find places that I could go and swim in. I mean, you know, we were up Tongariro, one of the mountains, volcanoes, and I swimming in volcanic lakes. And it did have an immediate and electrifying effect, I think, on a lot of people, because it suddenly, the core of the book, which is the idea of swimming as a connection with something bigger, with the past, was the right book at the right moment.
It's a template for an obsession.
That's a brilliant description. Yeah. It's a very accurate description.
I felt two things. I'd only ever dipped into the book. I'd never read it all the way through. Sorry, dipping in, I'll be saying it again. I apologise, but it's true. I'd only ever dipped into it. This is the first time I read it from cover to cover. And the two things that struck me coming to it as a book that I remember from the early 90s, and so I sort of remember the context you're talking about, Rachel, and the way it was published and how it was reviewed. I remember it being around, you know. Yeah. The two things that struck me were, first of all, at about the halfway point, I thought, oh, it's called Haunts of the Black Masseur, and then the subtitle is The Swimmer as Hero. And I thought, that subtitle is brilliant. Yeah. Whoever came up with that subtitle, because actually it's at the halfway point of the book, it begins to coalesce around the idea where you realise what you're reading, although it wanders around other topics, you are reading about people as much as swimming. The idea of what we invest in from Greek times through to the present day in heroic figures. And in this instance, it's heroic figures in relation to swimming, but it actually could be, there's a whole subtext there, I think, about human beings need to look at other human beings and put them on pedestals or diving boards as you see fit. The second thing that I thought about it, coming at it at this distance, was this would be a book that it would be much, much easier at least to imitate now because of the internet. And reading it now, there's so much. There's several, again and again, Sprawson does this thing where I read a paragraph and I thought, that's so condensed. You must have read three or four books to get that paragraph. Yeah. This must have taken you years to write. With no access to...
That was part of our sort of... where we were all blown away by the book, was the sort of... This is full of stuff that sent you scurrying in those days, not to Google, but to a bookshelf somewhere. And, oh, my God, and sort of, who's he talking about here? Who's this person? Who's that person? But it was just sort of just presented so elegantly and so...
Wes is learning right lightly.
Yeah, really.
But that's, I mean, Andy, I think that's fascinating, your idea about what the internet has done to the idea of learnedness. Because one of the people that I kept thinking of as I was reading it this time, I think perhaps because I just read James Wood's essay in The New Yorker on the comedy of W.G. Sebald. I think I think Sebald's very funny, and I think Sprawson here is very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Very funny.
He's melancholy, he's nostalgic, but he's also deeply, deeply humorous. Because like Sebald, he is, you know, he's learned, he's melancholy, he's nostalgic, but I think there is a real humour here, and I think it's a funny book.
I agree with you. In fact, I think we should listen to a bit of, this is Sprawson himself. There was a film of Haunts of the Black Masseur, of which there is a little clip up on YouTube.
You can get it. It's a Canadian production company. It's a good film.
I think, actually, if we listen to Sprawson speaking, this is one of those brilliant examples where once you hear his voice, you realise he writes like he speaks. So let's hear him now.
The Hellespont is the goal of every classical swimmer. A few miles inland are the remains of Troy. It's a place full of mythical associations. On the northern shore, on the European shore, the scenes of various Greek naval battles. So it's a place that's full of classical mystery. And for that reason, I and many other classes have wanted to swim it. When you come down the hill, as I did by car, and approach the Hellespont, it looks far narrower than one imagined, especially the narrowest place, the narrowest part of the channel. And I immediately started swimming across. I thought it would be so easy. And within 10 feet, I was pulled across towards the Aegean. If I hadn't clung to a rock, I'd have been swept miles away into the, far out into the Aegean. So I realized it wasn't as easy as I thought. And I took the ferry boat back and next day arranged for a boat to accompany me on a far wider bit of the channel.
Very busy traffic.
And it was quite rough and quite difficult, especially the last 200 yards. And I only just managed to get there.
It's so wonderful. It's the closest.
That's what I love about I'm so pleased you brought out the humour. But also, there isn't much scholarly apparatus, you know. There's not masses of footnotes. There isn't even a bibliography. It feels very like one of those wonderful 19th century, you know, works of scholarship, but with an incredibly kind of, that, as you say, that modern sensibility of this is all rather wonderful. Now it's not so wonderful, well, but I don't mind.
And it reminds you, because actually he calls upon so many of the characters that he then writes like. Because yes. I think the structure is very important, that he starts off giving you, if you like, a literary introduction to swimming. And what he does is he gets all of these people on side. So he takes you through people like George Borrow, like Swinburne, Shelley, Byron, Jack London. And then he uses them in the second half of the book to describe the world of swimming. So he is writing in a literary history of great writers who have written about swimming.
And how the thing that astonishes is just how important swimming... He puts a thesis down that you think, really?
Yes.
And then he totally nails it.
Absolutely.
You realise that actually this immersion in water that he writes about, that they all write about, the sense of being... There's a brilliant bit where he throws in a bit of Freud, saying, you know, it's sort of about wanting to be mothered and,
return,
you know,
the amniotic fluid.
Or return to the womb. But he does it all, you know, he doesn't force any of it. He tosses in his own observations almost casually. But what you realise is that, my God, yes, this being in water, from Goethe through to F. Scott Fitzgerald, so many writers, you suddenly see, I hadn't thought about literature, I hadn't thought about this strand of literature as being so important before.
And he was talking in the clip we listened to about Hellespont there. Could you say something about, the extent of my ignorance in this area was profound, I realised, as I read the book. But could you say something about why that is so important
to the book and to the swimming world? So the Hellespont is, you know, notoriously difficult to swim. I think my father tried it and maybe gave up, or did... There was one part of it where, anyway, it's Byron is the reason. Byron swam it, and it was the mark of Byron's heroism. It was the thing that set him apart from the people who pretended to be heroes and writers and weren't. And so for Sprawson, it is not only, you know, he's looking across to Troy. This is part of his classical background, but it's also about following in the footsteps of Byron, being the great swimmer writer.
Well, we'll talk a bit about Sprawson later on, but I just want... Normally on Backlisted, I have, you know, recourse to life stories and biographies...
Journals.
And journals, indeed. Sprawson's author note is, in and of itself, a tiny masterpiece. This is the published information about the author, Charles Sprawson, at the front of Haunts of the Black Mesa. Charles Sprawson studied at Trinity College Dublin, deals in 19th century paintings, and recently swam the Hellespont. I mean, that's wonderful. Whoever allowed that to pass, Rachel.
I seem to remember he was quite adamant that that was all that
it's,
we needed.
It's shrunk for the latest vintage edition. It's even smaller.
I think they've cut out the bit about him dealing in 19th century.
It's just says Charles Sprawson's an obsessional swimmer and diver who has swum the Hellespont. They've also, which is what I was trying to say, I think, bafflingly taken the subtitle off the cover.
That's a mistake.
Which I would say is a big mistake.
A deliberate
mistake. This is in the vintage classics edition. Yeah.
Alex, could you read us something that you feel...
Well, I think, you know, so clearly swimming the Hellespont is one of the kind of heroic moments of the book. But actually, another great moment is when he tries to swim the Tagus in Lisbon, which is...
This is great.
It's just wonderful, which Byron himself had done. So, my destiny... I'm not going to read like him because...
Take the whole podcast.
Well, exactly. My destination was a line of oil refineries on the other side, which once, in Byron's time, had been full of orange groves and vineyards. After an initial crawl, I relapsed into a stately side stroke, which allowed me the leisure to look back at the shore through the palisade of masts in the marina. Behind the railway, the oblong factories and rectangular blocks of flats were occasional glimpses of the old Baroque balconies and twisting towers that William Beckford had once admired. This perverse and exotic voluptuary, adored by Byron, who was always trying to catch up with him, had exiled himself here to escape the consequences of some homosexual scandal in England. It was along this shore that he rode every day and sometimes swam. He had installed in his extravagant apartment floor-length mirrors that reflected the bodies of young men swimming in the river below, and looking down at night from his veranda on the little beach, he would long to stretch himself on the sands by moonlight and devote all his wild imaginings to some lovesick, languid youth reclining by his side. Alas, he mourned, will my own youth pass away without my feeling myself once more tremblingly alive to these exquisite, though childish, sensations? By now, I was well over halfway across and drifting towards the suspension bridge, trying hard to distract my mind from what lay around and beneath me with memories of Beckford and others, when my thoughts were disturbed by the wail of a siren like those I imagined sounded at Alcatraz when a prisoner escaped from the island. Shortly afterwards, a patrol boat bore down on me. References to Byron made little impression. I was dragged from the water and subjected to an hour's interrogation. Apparently, no one was allowed to swim in the estuary unaccompanied by a boat and without the harbour master's permission. The river was considered too dirty and dangerous. Anyone spotted in it was either a drug smuggler or a stowaway, and treated as such. From the boat, the further shore seemed disappointingly close, but perhaps it was just as well. There was an ocean liner approaching fast from under the bridge, and there seemed little likelihood of my avoiding it.
Oh, so good. You know, when this book came out, we couldn't really think of precedents, could we?
No, there weren't any precedents. That was the really interesting thing. And that was why everyone was so excited about it. It was that sort of moment where... I mean, it was a particularly brilliant moment to be part of Jonathan Cape. It was 1992 when we actually published it. We'd won the Booker Prize with Ben Oakley in 1991. We had the legendary Peter Dyer designing all our beautiful covers. We were just fizzing with ideas of how to kind of get people to read books and stuff. And the idea that you weren't publishing something because somebody else had published something similar, you were publishing absolutely new kinds of books.
Well, this is my point, really, is in marked contrast to now, where the swimming memoir, or swim-war... Yes, I saw it referred to.
Swim-war.
That's become a, that's become
we're
a genre.
Swimming, aren't we?
Peak swimming.
Yeah. And Alex, I was going to say to you, I mean, I've just... Do you want to say something a bit about Philip Hoare's
novel? Well, I'm reviewing the new Philip Hoare called Rising Tide, Falling Star, all one word, which is...
Inspired by Changes One Bowie.
Yes.
I believe.
I think you're right, and Bowie is very important in it. Bowie is one of the few figures who isn't entirely immersed in cold water throughout the book.
Was David not a swimmer?
Sorry.
It's a book that owes a great deal to Sprawse, and only because it's the same kind of blueprint of a mind, and that mind being totally immersed in water and in cold water. You know, I think that's the other thing about Sprawse, is that, yes, it's Mediterranean, but also you feel he's sometimes at his happiest when he's freezing.
I've just been reading. Also, sorry, I keep saying this, I've been dipping into Jenny Landreth's book, which is called Swell, which was published by Bloomsbury earlier in the year. This is subtitled A Water Biography. And this is a book about... Actually, in a sense, this is rather like John Grinrod's book Outskirts I was talking about earlier. This is a mixture of two things. Her memoir of swimming, but also the role of women in the history of swimming.
Which don't get a huge part in... you know, if I were to...
Yeah. Precisely why I mention it.
Yeah, well, I think that... And Alexandra Hemmingsley's book, very similar,
well,
Leap In, which I love.
Finished reading Haunts of the Black Masser...
Amy Lipchow.
...and had quite enough of gilded Johnny Weissmuller male torso.
Yeah, morbidly self-admiring is how he describes them himself. But that's exactly what
there's
they are.
Phrase in Haunts of the Black Masser, which I'm not going to read out because I don't think you would put it in a book now... about the narcissism and how the narcissism relates to a particular medical condition that I think would probably be edited out.
Ah, yes, wasn't that interesting?
And so I could sort of see, I thought that was slightly dated, but it was. But I agree with you, Alex. I got to the end of the book and think, well, okay. And what's so interesting about Jenny's book, actually, almost, she likes... I asked her if she had read Haunts of the Black Masser. She likes it. She's not crazy about it. I felt that actually what's so interesting about it is that there almost felt like a dialogue going on between her book and that book. There are several points, for instance, where Captain Webb,
who's one of the great stories in
Victorian swimming heroes, Jenny takes quite some time to counterpoint stories of female swimmers whose exploits and achievements could easily be compared with Webb's, who, of course, were not.
That's
you know,
and it's, so it's
on
it's
the historical
that,
record in the same way.
It's interesting that Philip Hoard goes, I think quite self-consciously goes in the other direction and brings in Elizabeth Barrett Browning, brings in Virginia Woolf, brings in, you know, it wasn't a story of, Byron and his male acolytes.
There's a brief cameo of Virginia Woolf in The Cam with Rupert Brooke.
But it's about him, isn't it?
One of the people that really stands out in the Sproulsen book, though, is Zelda Fitzgerald.
Yes.
Oh, yes. That's true.
A spectacularly sort of intrepid diver and shucker off of flesh-coloured...
We don't do conservation, she
says. She's marvellous. We should say that this book, The Haunts of the Black Masser, also contains cameo appearances by several writers that we've talked about on Backlisted. So my great favourite, WNP Barbellion... author of Journal of a Disappointed Man, is in here. Edmund Goss is in here, author of Father and Son.
Denton Welsh,
who I discovered through Backlisted and now am obsessed with. I think he's a wonderful writer.
Scott Fitzgerald is in here.
Yeah, who didn't swim because he was embarrassed of
his feet.
And J.G. Ballard.
Yes.
J.G. Ballard here is there's a Ballard's quote on the back here. Says, part social and cultural history and part personal credo. Haunts of the Black Masser is an exhilarating plunge into some of the deepest pools inside our heads. Of course, J.G. Ballard, even in a blurb, unable to leave out a mention of a swimming pool. but also, we have a clip as well. You cannot talk about writing about swimming without talking about the story The Swimmer by John Cheever. And here we have a clip of Cheever reading from The Swimmer.
Amazing.
Then it occurred to him that by taking a dog leg to the southwest, he could reach his home by water. The day was beautiful, and it seemed to him that a long swim might enlarge and celebrate its beauty. He took off a sweater that was hung over his shoulders and dove in. He had an inexplicable contempt for men who did not hurl themselves into pools. He swam a choppy crawl, breathing either with every stroke or every other full stroke, and counting somewhere well in the back of his mind the 1-2, 1-2 of a flutter kick. It was not a serviceable stroke for long distances, but the domestication of swimming had saddled the sport with some customs, and in his part of the world, a crawl was customary. To be embraced and sustained by the light green water was less a pleasure, it seemed, than the resumption of a natural condition, and he would have liked to swim without trunks, but this was not possible, considering his mission. He hoisted himself up on the far curb, he never used the ladder, and started across the lawn. When Lucinda asked where he was going, he said he was going to swim home.
Now, That is an extract of Cheever reading from the story of the swimmer in 1975. There was, of course, a film made of the swimmer, a wonderful
brilliant film.
As I said, I was saying to somebody this morning, it's like an episode of The Twilight Zone directed by Antonioni. It's starring Burt Lancaster. Burt Lancaster, who is mentioned in Haunts of the Black Mass, had to learn to swim for it.
But the reason it's such a good story is because it gets that thing that, again, Sprawson does so well, of the kind of dreamlike altered state of being in water, that I think that the thing at the end of The Swimmer, which we won't give away because it is kind of an extraordinary reveal, but it does something to your consciousness of a reader, and I always wish I could read that story for the first time again because of the surprise of the ending.
Yeah. It's funny rereading Sprawson after so long. Having read more. You know, you've read more, 25 years, you've read different stuff. But no one, I think, has nailed the sense of the sheer sensual... I mean, it's both sensual deprivation, but also completely the relationship. I just wanted to read this little bit from Flaubert. The sense of the mind and body being kind of in harmony through swimming, which he just says, "My sole pastime, my only sport, was the purest of all, swimming. It seems to me that I discover and recognize myself when I return to this universal element. My body becomes the direct instrument of my mind, the author of its ideas. To plunge into water, to move one's whole body from head to toe in its wild and graceful beauty, to twist about in its pure depths, this is for me a delight only comparable to love." It's just...
That's Flaubert.
But that's the genius of Sprawson. Going back to this internet, this is years of reading and note taking, and what it's not cutting and pasting from the internet. It's the sort of, you could sort of feel that it is the work of a lifetime.
It's as though he's just casually saying it all the way through.
Yeah.
He's just telling you.
Drop stuff in.
Dropping stuff in as though you were having a conversation.
There's one bit near the start where he can't remember where the quote's from, and he refers to something as like...
He just said it somewhere, yeah. He says, yeah.
That's right.
But he does this wonderful thing of getting both the kind, that sensuous, Roger Deakin in Waterlogue, which is a book he talks about being enveloped by the water, this sensual, sensuous nature of it. But he also, Sprawson gets the kind of lustral, purifying nature of the water as well, and I think the balance there is one of the kind of it's one of the frictions in the book that drives it along.
I love this quote here. Sorry, Alex, you were talking earlier about the humour. And there's an anecdote here. Bertrand Russell bathed by moonlight with Rupert Brooke off Lulworth. And in his autobiography, records his last friendly encounter with Asquith, the Prime Minister.
Yeah, that's very good.
Which he felt the most surprising incident of his whole life. Quote, "I was walking on a hot summer's day in Oxfordshire, along the banks of a small river, and I got so warm that I thought I would go in and bathe. And I went in and bathed. The place seemed completely lonely, and I bathed without a costume. When I came out, who should I find standing on the bank but the Prime Minister? A great surprise to me. It was no occasion for dignity or for serious discussion of great political problems. I put on my clothes as quickly as I could while he conversed in an amiable manner, and that was the last time I had a friendly, comfortable relation with Mr. Asquith."
Brilliant.
It's so good. But again, it's what you were saying about, Rachel, what you were saying about the an anecdote has been noticed in the reading of a book which presumably had nothing else in it that could be brought to the book, noted down, put away.
I like that bit in the sort of introductory chapter where he says, you know, there was a period where he was just writing notes about every time he noticed anything about swimming, he wrote it down, and then he said the crazed irrelevance of these notes. I do now acknowledge.
But you get that when you're obsessed with something, it's everywhere. He says novels and poetry seem to revolve around water and swimming in a way that that was quite out of proportion to the author's intentions. And anyone who's really... I mean, I've been doing it with birds recently. It's like there's birds in everything I'm reading.
It's confirmation bias.
It's confirmation bias. It's total confirmation bias.
But you know when it's... That's what I always think. You know when it's working once you see the connection.
Can I do one more funny anecdote? Because it just this made me laugh a lot. Signs of urine in his pool shocked Orson Welles. In an attempt to embarrass the culprits, he found a chemist who had developed a clear, colourless liquid which, on insertion in the water, could immediately detect those who had abused their privileges. We put this stuff in and we invited our friends out, naturally at the weekend, and they were swimming around in raspberry-coloured clouds. They were all doing it, you see. We discovered during our scientific investigation that it was overwhelmingly the men who did it, and women of advanced years.
This is very good, Orson Welles.
The awful revelation that so many of his sophisticated friends habitually misused the pool in this way greatly dismayed him.
Greatly dismayed him.
I mean, it's genius.
You see, that's that beautiful, that greatly dismayed. It's just can I just read this? This is the thing, if you've read a book 25 years ago and I haven't read it since, although I've pressed on hundreds of people, you suddenly start reading it and sentences that have somehow lodged themselves inside you come back. And this is one that he's talking about the Diocletian's baths in Rome. And how they were turned into a basilica and a church. A basilica designed by Michelangelo, and he's swimming in there, and he's admiring the columns, which are hewn out of single blocks of stone 43 feet high. He's distracted recently by the sight of those startling columns and that of a gypsy's naked breast feeding a pendant infant. I lost through her liquid fingers all the money in my possession.
I wrote that one down as well. He could do stand-up. But it makes you want to know about him as a person.
Okay, so we have to talk about this.
I want to go back to learning. Why are there so many books about swimming?
Yes.
And what's on the other side? You can sing that to the Rainbow Connection. Why are there so many books about swimming?
Well, I mean, I think partly for exactly what Sprawson is writing about, that there is this is not confirmation bias, this is not a false relationship. There is an intimate link between writing and swimming, I think. I think the kind of dream state that you get into when you're writing is very similar to the one you get into when you're swimming. I think there's absolutely no surprise that so many writers have been obsessed by the sea. It's entering a different medium. It's finding a different way of relating to your own consciousness. And I think that it is a kind of, you know, the swimmer is hero.
Yeah.
You're writing stories as you're moving through the water. I do a lot of writing when I'm swimming. I swim in a pool mainly. I do swim in a river and in the sea occasionally. But I will, on a Sunday night, I will go and I will swim for an hour and I will come out energised and full of ideas.
You know, also you were saying, weren't you, that we were talking about the sort of the narcissistic element and the idea of mirrors is a big thing in the book. And it occurs to me that it's a book, in a sense, it's an obsessive book, as you say, a book of obsession, about obsessed people. The swimmers that he is interested in are the ones who will swim themselves to death. Often, you know, they are the ones who will immerse themselves so deep that they never come back.
But listen, we have to ask, what happened to Sprawson? He publishes, this is 25 years.
Let me tell you a little bit about Sprawson before this was published, because actually what I did when I knew we were doing this was I went and I spoke to everyone I could find who knew him. So everyone from Tash Orr, the great, great novelist, great writer, to David Godwin, to Nicholas Pearson, who was his editor. So he was, as Rachel said, born in Pakistan, raised in India. His father was the headmaster of a school for Indian princes, as he sort of refers to at the beginning. He studied at Trinity Dublin, played squash for Ireland, and worked as a swimming pool attendant. He taught literature in Saudi Arabia and then established a fine art dealership in London, specializing in Victorian painting, which he would go out and sell for a few weeks each year to people in the Channel Islands. And this was his market. And so he... And his coming to the Channel Islands was a real red letter day for the tax exiles out there. And he would have... he would be asked to stay with various couples out there. One couple had asked him to get paintings of every British prime minister, of whom I think there have been 50 or so. Another couple... used to wait until he drove his car onto the ferry to leave, and then they would let off a firework as he left.
I can just say, harbour. John and mine, our faces could be described as creased with delight at the moment.
Everyone I spoke to was full of the most extraordinary... Yeah. You know, you could just tell that people were grinning at the thought of him, and he sounded like the most wonderful... And I'm speaking... He's still alive.
He's out there.
He's still out there. Another reason I love him is that... So that one of the reasons I'm so totally obsessed with swimming is that my dad is a big swimmer and taught me to swim, and we have swum a lot together. And my dad read this book. I gave it to him and loved it so much. He found out where Sprawson was living and started writing to him, and they began a correspondence. I asked my dad when he'd last heard from Charles, and he said, well, it was a few years ago, and he really wasn't well. And he came down with, I think, cancer of the throat a few years back and has really been going through a difficult time. And obviously, you know, I got an email via Nicholas Pearson saying that he was on the mend, that he was potentially coming out of hospital and that things are looking up, and that he's working on another book.
Wow.
A book about a great and obviously completely insane swimmer called, Martin Strel. Yeah. Strel? Strel, I think. Who's a Slovenian who swam the Amazon, decided it wasn't quite far enough, and carried on swimming.
He holds all these amazing records, Martin Strel.
You know, but when I first talked to David Godwin about it, David hadn't heard that he was getting better, and actually gave me very bad news about Charles's condition. And then my dad, I spoke to my dad again, and my dad said, "I don't know whether to tell you this or not. I didn't tell you at the time because I knew you'd be so upset because I knew how much you loved the book, but." Charles came to one of your book launches because he'd heard that you were such a fan, and you were all caught up in it, you know, being a cock. And he didn't come and say hello.
Oh!
He bought a copy of the book and left.
God.
And just the thought. So I've
That's
actually
so Charles.
Nicholas has put me in touch with his stepdaughter and. Daughter-in-law. I can't. Anyway, with a member of his family, and I am going to go and visit him because this is a book that has been one of the kind of props of my life and has played such a role in who I am and what I'm interested in. And that thing you do when you reach about our age, where you finally realise the things that make you really happy, yeah, and you just do them as much as you can. And swimming and reading are two of those things, and that's why I want everyone to read this book. And that, going back to your question at the beginning, it's not just a book for swimmers. It's a book about obsession. It's a book about love, and it's a book about literature.
Well, that's fantastic, Alex, and we can say no more. That is absolutely brilliant place to end. Thank you. Well, thank you to Alex.
I'm not going swimming, man. I mean, I'll read another book.
John Rachel and I now take Andy and throw him
in the canal
again.
There's a pike out there, Andy.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you to Alex Preston, to Rachel Kerr, to our producer Matt Hall, and again to our sponsors Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at Backlisted Pod, Facebook, facebook.com/backlistedpod, and on our page on the Unbound site, which is unbound.com/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight. Until then, goodbye.
I was going to sing some of Loudon Wainwright III's The Swimming Song at this point, but well, I decided that I can't
Boss
possibly...
Lido Shuffle?
The, right? I don't want the pathetic drop after after Alex's wonderful... I would like to add that what a pleasure it is,
massive,
as it so often is on Backlisted, to have the opportunity to discover or discover anew a book like this one. So thank you very much, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
And we'll see you next time.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.